Good morning. Before we start this session, I should announce that John Wheeler passed away yesterday, and I think we should have a brief period of silence in memory of a great physicist. Won't you stand and thank you. Next speaker is C.W. Chu, High Temperature Superconductivity, 20 Years Later, Achievements, Promises, and Challenges. Thank you.
It's a great honor and pleasure to be here this morning. I would like to share with you what happened to HT, High Temperature Superconductivity, Science and Technology 20 years later. As our chairman just mentioned, I'm going to talk about the achievements. Indeed, lots of things have been done in the last 20 years. Great progress has been made. But then many of the promises have not been realized, although some of them have. And there are lots of challenges lying ahead of us. But at the same time, I think many of you probably realize there is a very exciting development over the last month or so on the newly discovered iron-based high-temperature superconducting system. And I would like to briefly include that in today's presentation. It's frozen. Let me see if I can do something. Yeah, okay. I'll come back. Oh, okay. As I mentioned, over there I listed my affiliation with University of Houston and also Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. In the last 6-7 years, I learned one thing, being the president of a university. You always like to show some good things about your university, and that's Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. As you can see here, it's a beautiful scenery of Hong Kong. If you go past the mountain on this side, and that's where the university is located, it looks like this is the main gate of the university. If you look from the ocean, it looks like this. This is our university. If you move up to this building, and that's where my office is located, and that's how it looks like. So all of you are welcome if you have time to visit us. Well, 2007, indeed, it was a special year because it was 20th anniversary of the discovery of the YBCO, which is the first liquid nitrogen high-temperature superconductor. And it's also the 50th anniversary of the non-conservation of parity proposed, and the 50th anniversary of the development of BCS theory. Actually, if you go a year earlier, or the same year, it was also the 21st anniversary of the discovery of the 30th degree superconductor by Alex Miller and George Badenoch, which started the era of high-temperature superconductivity. And the 51st anniversary of the proposition of Cooper-Pair, and also the 301st anniversary for the publication of the Principia Mathematica, which inaugurated the really modern science. So 2008 may be equally special, because as I mentioned already, there was a new superconducting system just discovered with TC up to 53 degrees. High temperature superconductivity is scientifically challenging. It offers new paradigms for our understanding of solids and physics. Technologically promising because it holds key to the sustainable development of the world and many other things. We all know that the constraints for future global economic growth are the following: energy, environmental, and resources. Energy holds the key, and HTS, high-temperature superconductor, can play a crucial role in electricity use and also electric power quality delivery and quality controls. Well, let's look at the map of Asia at night. You all recognize that this bright spot is Japan, this South Korea, this east coast of China, Taiwan, and this bright spot is where Hong Kong is located. And there is a very unusual spot here. You all know what that is. That's North Korea. So in other words, where there is light, that is electricity, there is prosperity. And that's why this country also looked into it very carefully. In the year of 2001, Jimmy Garfield of the DOE proposed to build a super grid for energy highway, and which consists of a backbone covering the major four grid system in North America, and then connected by regional grids and microgrids for the city, and then put on the IT and to build a smart grid system, and this will change the world's largest industry. The time when we were talking about this, the U.S. had $1 trillion surplus, and you know what the situation now. But even though if you have the money, there's also some major constraints. That is the cryogenics to cover such large distance. So the solution is to look for room temperature superconductors or super cryogenics technology. A few years ago, Professor Xu, the president of the Chinese Academy of Engineering, came out to Hong Kong 2 years ago and talked to me about the environmental issue. And he had this curve plotting pollution as a function of GDP per capita. And this is the path that all the industrialized country has followed in past centuries. At the beginning, every country was poor and clean. And then they move up, making pollution, and the world becomes dirty. And now many industrialized country is rich and still dirty. And then realize the importance of environmental problems, start to clean. The goal is try to be rich and clean. And let's see where China is located. China is at this position, okay? And remember, this is GDP per capita. And you multiply by 1.3 billion people, and the world would not have enough energy, materials, or resources to support this development following this path. So Professor Xu asked me, can we find a tunneling model going from here to here? Indeed, it's very good if we could find it. But I think we need technology, and that's not sufficient. We also need to change the economic models. In addition, we have to change the social behavior and everyone's living styles. By that, I think probably we can find something, maybe not exactly like this, but probably going through something like this. Okay. So in order to do that, superconductivity, as I mentioned, it holds some key roles. So searching for a new superconductor with a higher TC has long been the main driving force for superconductivity research. The BCS theory is simple, elegant, and descriptive, but lacks of the predictive power for higher TC for a long time. So when we look back in 1986, at that time, experimentally, the highest temperature was 23.2 degrees until Alex Miller and George Batnell's discovery. And so people also spent a lot of time looking for novel superconducting materials. Theoretically, at that time, the theory predicted the TC cannot go above the 30s. And of course, they also proposed many novel mechanisms. During that period of time, what we had was the confidence crisis in research in high temperature superconductivity. But the situation changed when Alex Miller and George Batnell's paper came, and they essentially set a new record of 35 degrees in the new oxide materials. And this changed the world. And then immediately after that, when we realized what happened, and then we reproduced the results, and then we applied pressure, we enhanced the temperature to 40.2 degrees and then to 52.4 degrees. With a TC greater than 40 degrees, basically defies the then theoretical predictions, gave us confidence that high TC was possible. And then, in addition to that, the unusually large pressure effect on TC implies that cuprate, copper oxide system, is very unusual and therefore warrant further studies. I should mention that back in 1986, November, we already saw some anomaly happening. This resistivity versus temperature anomaly starting at the 70 degrees Kelvin. And I think during that period of time, we made several decisions. And that is, I decided to invite my former student, M.K. Wu's group from Alabama, to join us on the search, and during the APS meeting. And then we focused on the really high TC anomaly, as just shown you here, instead of pursuing the 214 phase. Although we were doing that, that's what the whole country, the whole world was pursuing. And then proposed to stabilize this anomaly by replacing elements, different elements. So then, I think in January 1987, when we measured doing magnetic measurements of this kind of samples, we already saw Meissner effect starting at 100 degrees in the lanthanum copper oxide. But then the time when I started writing the manuscript, and then my student, M.K. Wu, called, he already got the YBCO, this phase stabilized using the YBCO. As you can see here, that was January 29th, 1987, and then immediately we also measured the magnetization, confirmed that this is indeed a stable superconductivity. So this was the first superconductors above 77 degrees Kelvin that was stabilized. And then the YBCO, people call it 123 or YBCO, essentially it's yttrium barium 2 copper 3 oxygen 7. As I already mentioned, it's the first stable liquid nitrogen temperature superconductor. So then after that, immediately a whole series of compounds was discovered. And that result was published on March the 2nd, 1987. And it was quite interesting for many people, particularly those people from Texas. We considered that day was a super day for physics because 90 degree superconductivity and also supernova observed was also announced that day. In addition, the country was talking about building the superconducting supercollider. So what we have learned scientifically right now, materially, there are more than 150 non-intermetallic compounds with a TC above 23 degrees Kelvin, and they group into several systems. And we also learned that high-temperature superconductors with TC higher than 77 degrees belong to layer cuprates. And now the HC2 for YBCO, for example, and among other, it's orders, the highest is about 150 Tesla at 0 degrees Kelvin, and it's about 3 million times of the Earth magnetic field. The critical current density is above 10 to the 6 ampere per centimeter squared, and also if at 77 degrees. If you are willing to lower the temperature to 4.2 degrees, it's more than 10 to the 7 ampere per centimeter squared at 0 field, and it's much better, at 0 degrees, I'm sorry, and it's much better than the LTS, the low temperature superconductors that we have been using now. And the surface impedance is also very, very good, so therefore for electronics applications. And at this moment, the highest TC occurs. Here I plot the transition temperature TC as a function of time. As you can see right now, the highest superconductor is mercury-based materials, cuprate materials, has a transition temperature 134 degrees without pressure. If you apply pressure, it goes up to 164 degrees Kelvin. And among all these high-temperature superconductors, there are only three systems people can make wire out of. And one is the bismuth material, base material, we call it viscose. I'll come back to that point later. And then we also have this YBCO materials and also a material discovered in 2001, the MGB2 material. So the reason material discovered, it's rare earth, oxygen, iron, arsenide, and doped with fluorine. And the TC goes up to 53 degrees Kelvin. So when we look at the YBCO, I mentioned their layer structure, as you can see here. Sorry. Now, you can see it here. And basically, let's look at YBCO. They are all in layers. It turns out you can group them into two groups. This group consists of copper oxygen 2 square planar layers. And that group where the supercurrent flows usually. And then the other group, so therefore we call this as active blocks. And the other, this is providing doping. Just like semiconductor, usually when you change elements here, it will introduce charges into this active layers. And through this so-called modulation doping in semiconductors. And I mentioned this because this is related to the ion-based material later. So then, in terms of the science over the last two decades, they can be summarized into one generic five-phase diagram. And this is doping, and this is normalized transition temperature. And so you can see at the beginning, they are antiferromagnetic insulator. When you dope them, finally it gets you into a state. When you cool them enough, become superconducting. But even before they get into the superconducting state, they already show some unusual anomalies over there, here, and they call it pseudo gap is being created. And there are some other anomalies here. And so basically to do the doping, one can use chemical method or using high pressure or using photon or using electric fields. But up to this point, the most effective one perhaps remains to be the chemical doping. And then the other things, it has a complex magnetic phase diagrams. And this phase diagram basically is the same like conventional superconductor, except because of its high TC, it expands the temperature space. So therefore, one can do detailed study in this region. And if they found all kinds of unusual physics, and you look into vortex liquid, vortex solid, and dilute superfluid liquid down here. And there, even this phase diagram is still not clear at this moment. It's very rich in physics, and it's critical for applications. People are interested in HTS, high temperature superconductivity, basically was due to its potential applications. And this material can be used for base stations, wireless communication base station filters, for example. And by using this, in the conventional way, usually you have drop-off region. You cannot, this is 28 miles separation between two base stations. And then, well, the drop-off is not clear. When you use superconducting filters, it becomes clearer in this case. So therefore, it will increase the range and also coverage. And in addition, it will increase efficient use of the bandwidth because of the resonance is sharper. Right now, there are thousands of stations in the field being tested. The other thing is for medical diagnostics. This was done by my students. And actually, it's a superconducting device here. We call it SQUID, superconducting quantum interference device. And then without touching it, and you can see, it can map out the real magnetic field above the chest. And as you can see, this is a real-time thing. And this is the MCG. It's similar to the EKG plot. And between the S and T region, this region, when the heart relaxes, it carries some important information concerning the health state of the heart. In order to do this experiment, actually, I went to have my own heart checked up. They told me my heart is very good, you know. So do that. And then we map out the real field and use the dipolar current model. We got a representation of this map. And then one of my colleagues who had a heart problem but on medication, and you can see the EKG, it's almost the same. But then we take the MCG, that's magnetocardiogram, at the same time, and you can see definitely difference. That means it carries more information than the EKG can carry. But of course, due to what, we don't know yet. Because my colleague felt good under medication, and yet here it shows something unusual. Now, it can be also used to use as antenna or the sensor of the MRI system. My colleague Worsek actually did the experiment. What he did is this: put the superconducting sensor inside the styrofoam cup and then fill it with liquid nitrogen, and he could do imaging of the rat, the spinal cord, and he can review all the detailed structure, microstructure here, and also the brain up here. Now you can see using copper, you could do the imaging, but the quality of the image is much poorer. And in addition, you have to implant the coil underneath the skin of the poor mouse. You know? But by doing this, you don't have to do that. And then, of course, the most impressive demonstration was done by John Clark at LBL at Berkeley. And essentially, he could do, using squid as a sensor, to do earth field MRI. And in fact, this technology is being pursued at Los Alamos at this moment. As you can see here, this is the phantom, essentially a plastic with hole drilled with holes and filled with water. And then you can see at the field, even lower the Earth magnetic field, he could do a sharp image here. Of course, once you increase the field by 1,000 times approximately, you can see it becomes smeared. And we all know this, when you use strong field, usually you get a stronger signal, you're supposed to increase the noise to signal ratio. But when you do that, you also introduce lots of noise into the system. So therefore, this holds great promises, you know, doing MRI for medical purpose. The other thing is to try to use this for energy storage, because superconductor can repel magnets, you know. So therefore, the magnet can flow on top of it. And this was done by my colleague Wei Kan Chu, and this is a flywheel. It's going to, it's lifted by a superconductor down here, and therefore he can spin it up to 6,000 RPM, and then it will coast down. It will coast down to stop in. It won't coast down. It won't stop until 6 days later. If you use conventional bearing, it will stop in about 15 minutes. So that tells you the energy dissipation using this kind of scheme is very, very good. At this moment, Boeing is building a megawatt flywheel for energy storage purpose. And there are many efficient, compact, environmentally friendly electric power equipment built. For example, this demonstration for power cables, there are many in Japan, in Norway, and the United States doing that. And motor generators, this was built in Cleveland. And synchronous condensers to improve the grid qualities done by American Superconductor. And four current limiters, this is actively being pursued at this moment in several places, including our center in Houston. And transformer, as you can see here, and magnetic levitation train. And this was originally built based on the low temperature superconductors, and now they are trying to retrofit and put the high temperature superconducting material into it. And the other thing is, this was a ship propulsion motor which was delivered to the Navy last year, manufactured by American Superconductor. And you can see it's less than half the size, less than one third the weight, higher net efficiency, equivalent prices, and inherently quieter. So it has lots of advantages here. Well, I think many people in this meeting probably will be interested in the accelerator. What's the potential of using that? Of course, I remember when the whole thing happened, at that time people were thinking about building a tabletop accelerator. But I think that day will take some time to realize. But at least you can see here is the critical current density as a function of magnetic field. These red colors lines represent the YBCO material. I should mention up to this point, YBCO turns out is the best material for application in spite of the lower TC than other materials. And now you can see this viscoelastic material and the blue color, and this at different temperatures. You can see 77 is here for YBCO. And here is the best material for the conventional superconductors, niobium 318. If you want to go higher, probably you have to go to YBCO. People are also interested in magnets, and I think you know better than I. I just want to show you, in 2007, there was a new record set by Florida State High Field Magnet Lab, get up to 26.8 Tesla superconducting magnets with an insert in it. And of course, there are others, higher one, but only for pulse, you know, for pulse magnets. Now, so let's look at the challenges in materials. Because for science, we really need to know, determine the intrinsic properties of the material. But the materials are physically intricate, chemically complex, and also unstable for these materials. So therefore, what we like to do is that the high TC is good for us, but also introduce into the measurement of many other kinds of excitations, you know. And in addition, it's sensitive to doping and highly anisotropic, inhomogeneous, and sample perfections, you know, is a problem, a challenge. A good sample size is also a challenge. And the material base up to this year, it was only copper-based, and now we are very lucky to have iron-based material discovered. In terms of technology, we need a high performance and low cost, and also the materials have to be in the proper form for devices. So therefore, one would like to increase the TC, JC, and coherence length. And the material, this kind of performance, of course, depends on the intrinsic properties of the material, but also one can improve it through processing. Okay? One can also improve the cryogenic efficiency and many other concerning the grain boundaries, and impurity sensitivity, and so on and so forth. And the lifetime certainly is an important problem. And so the challenges in science, well, there are many problems. I just want to put down four of them. What is the mechanism responsible for high temperature superconductivity remains unknown. And when will there be a microscopic, comprehensive microscopic theory? And also, do high temperature superconductors form a class of materials of their own? Still not clear. Can there be a room temperature superconductor? And at this moment, no generally accepted microscopic theory yet. The Holy Grail, I remember Professor Kramer talked about Holy Grail in his field. And in our field, the Holy Grail in high temperature superconducting science and technology is to find a room temperature superconductor. At this moment, there's no reason, either theoretical nor or experimental, why it does not exist. And also for those people, diehard high temperature superconductor workers, including myself, we always have the strong belief and optimism that whatever physics law does not say, it won't happen well. So we have learned from high temperature superconductivity in the last two decades from material point of view. I think we learn many things. We expect to expect the unexpected. And also very often, even with doing that, TC goes up, novel physics discovered, a new material discovered, and what's in. And also we learn a lot about what's in common for high temperature superconductivity. And so the first thing is here, let me mention electron pairing and phase coherence, that definitely happens there, just like the low temperature superconductors. They belong to a group so-called strongly correlated electron systems. There are lots of instabilities in this class of materials, and it has layer structure with two different subcomponents, as I just mentioned for the YBCO as an example. It's near the metal insulating phase boundary. It has mixed valence and it has magnetism apparently, or even with spin specifically, one half like copper. Now, the newly discovered iron-based high-temperature superconductors with the TC up to 52 degrees, it's represented by this formula, and it's called rare earth iron oxyarsenide. Okay. It's doped with fluorine in here. It's called rare earth iron arsenides here. Its layer structure, as I mentioned, you can see here, iron arsenide here, one layer. That's where the conductivity is supposed to go through. And out here is oxygen lanthanum form the outer layer, the insulating layer, and to provide charges into here. So just like the YBCO and the rare cupric high temperature superconductors. Actually, it comes. This class of material was discovered a long time ago in 1995 and later on the phosphide-based material and then arsenide-based material in the year of 2000 by two groups in Germany, as you can see here. And then in 2006, Hosanna's group in Japan already found superconductivity in this compound, on the phosphide compounds, with TC around 5 degrees. And then he doped it with fluoride, it went up to 12 degrees onset here. And then the following year, they found nickel also had become superconducting, but the TC is lower at 3K, the same group. And then, of course, finally, it's this year that I think I lost that transparency. And this year, and so, yeah, okay. And this year, this came out. And I think many of you have seen it. And by doing, no, I'm sorry. This one, you can see it. Until this, there was no one paying attention to it. But beginning of this year, when this came out, people got very excited. They measure resistivity. They measure magnetic susceptibility. They also construct a phase diagram. You look at resistivity, there's a sharp drop at this point. They call it T anomalous temperature. And then they identify the minimum as T minimum here, and then superconducting transition temperature, of course, you know, they can plot it. And turns out the phase diagram was quite similar to what I showed you earlier for the cuprate materials. Of course, whether this is meaningful or not, it's not clear at this moment, okay? But they propose that this is caused by the spin density wave gap creation, and because once you dope it, the spin density wave gap disappears, and then superconductivity comes up, and then that's what happened. Okay. So let me just show you how the excitement. The excitement can be represented here. After their announcement, and finally the news came to the United States and outside the world, I believe in the end of February, immediately you can see in China, probably it's closer to that. I attribute it to another reason, because that period of time was APS meeting. All my students, they all went to the meetings. And so the group, two groups, basically, this University of Science and Technology and Hefei of China, and then the Institute of Physics, different groups over there. You see, March the 25th, they raised the temperature 43 degrees by replacing lanthanum with samarium, and then replacing it with cerium on March the 26th, they raised the temperature to 41, and then by 28th, they raised the temperature to 52, and then another group found it at 52, as you can see here. Immediately, tens of papers published in the following weeks or so. You can see it's quite exciting. People like to work on this system because it's a new system. People believe that by understanding it, it will also help us understand the mechanism, even in the cuprate high-temperature superconductors. And people also got that euphoria, thinking that the sky will be the limit for high TC. So because of that, we decided to look into the interplay between high-temperature superconductivity and the spin density wave of this highest transition temperature at the time, the first high one. So we did that. It turns out it's very simple. So we look at this samarium iron arsenide, and you can see without doping, the resistivity, this is resistivity as a function of temperature, at around 140, 150 degrees, there was a sharp turnover drop. And then when you dope it with 5% of fluorine, that anomaly is reduced and pushed to lower temperature. When you go up to 13%, this is all nominal, not exactly. And you can see superconductivity came in. And then when you dope it with 30%, and it becomes superconducting at 44, 45 degrees at this point. So we decided to apply and also try to look at the thermoelectric power and see what happened. The purely undoped sample, there is an anomaly coming up at this point. These are two samples, not just the samarium, but also the lanthanum sample. It goes like this, so they are all similar. And then when we dope it, that anomaly removed immediate turnover like this, and then finally becomes superconducting, you know, going like this. And this Seebeck coefficient actually comes down first and then going up again, going like this. In fact, we just got some really interesting data at this moment in the lab showing this system may have undergone into a heavy fermion system. And so we apply pressure. Forget about the details. You can see we apply pressure. It starts out at 43.5 degrees. And then it goes down. And then finally, release pressure comes back up here. But unfortunately, when we remove the pressure totally, and the sample degrades. But there's no doubt it's coming down. Because before this time, everyone thought, I have 1 minute or 2 minutes, okay, I'll be done. Before that, people all thought, you know, applying pressure will raise the TC to sky high, and also by putting fluorine, it would do the same thing. Turns out it's not, it comes down. And then for the other sample, lower TC one, this one, and we found it indeed goes up, as you can see here. So that means the following. Or in addition, we look at spin density wave gap. And without doping, it goes like this. This is a 3% doping. It's still there. When we apply pressure, we can see the peak is shifted to a lower temperature. In order to see this is really correct, because this we have to take the derivative. It's difficult to see. So then we also measure the thermoelectric power of this sample. And you can see the thermoelectric power turn around. At this point, when we apply pressure, indeed it goes to lower temperature. So there's no doubt. But even up to this point, people don't understand whether there's a structure transformation involving phonons or not. So we decided to measure the Raman it turns out from the Raman measurement, there's no difference above and low, below, because there's less than 1% shift in the Raman lines that can be accounted for the contraction of the sample. So there's no phonon involved. So I think the original proposition by Kamihara and co-workers that this may be a charge spin density wave is correct. Okay. So we found that it's similar to RBCO, and then pressure can enhance but also suppress TC depending on the doping level, whether it's underdoped or overdoped. And it follows, it may follow a universal TC versus doping curve independent of the R. In other words, if you want to find TC higher in the same structure, probably it's kind of difficult. And we think the maximum TC is in the 50 to 60 range for all the R, independent of the rare earth elements. The TC of lanthanum-based material, cerium-based material, samarium-based material may be raised to 50s. As I show you, this was originally 26, and this was 41, and this was 43, 45 degrees. And indeed, samarium has been raised to 53 already. And we hope these two will also be raised if the sample and doping remain stable. And for TC higher than the 50s, I think probably we should examine similar tool but different from this system. And many interesting experiments are waiting for us to do. And thank you for your attention.
Time for about two questions. Yes, use the microphone, please.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I can see immediately how high temperature superconductivity can improve the spatial resolution of the MRIs. I was wondering if there's any hope for the temporal resolution. And in addition, from a physiological perspective, with regard to the magnetocardiogram, I was wondering what that measures. Does it measure the vascular blood flow, or does it measure something else?
Yes. It basically is measuring the blood flow through the heart. It generates because there's a voltage across it, and it generates a magnetic field through the blood flow.
And what about the time resolution?
The time resolution can be in the millisecond range. It can do real time also. Right now, the basic challenge for us now is that we don't know exactly how it's related to the physiological condition of the body, because we measured everything together, okay? Even though we know it's the heart, but we cannot pinpoint. So I think at the beginning we have to depend on the conventional MRI technique and try to learn more about the MCG technique at this moment. But as you all know, when you go to the hospital, ask the doctors to do testing, it costs lots of money, you know, so that's the drawback at this moment. And there is a company in Boston by Carl Rossner already pushed for this MCG system.
Let's thank President Chu again.
Thank you.